Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So there's two verses without a purport, 34 and 35. So I'll chant those myself. I'll just chant the Sanskrit, read the English translation, and then we could do 36 together. Okay? So you could have 36 up there. Isa shikeshan vidur ambuvahan vasastu sandhyam kuruvarya bhumna avyaktam ahur hridayam manascha sachandrama sarva vikara kosha. Translation. O best among the crews, the clouds which carry water are the hairs on his head. The terminations of days or nights are his dress. And the supreme cause of material creation is his intelligence. His mind is the moon, the reservoir of all changes. 35. Vijnana shaktim mahim amananti sarvatmanonta karanam giritatram. Ashvashvatar yustri gajanakani sarve mriga pasava shroni deshi. Translation. The principle of matter, Mahatattva, is the consciousness of the omnipresent Lord. And as asserted by the experts. And Rudradev is his ego. The horse, mule, camel, and elephant are his nails. And wild animals and all quadrupeds are situated in the belt zone of the Lord. And now we could do this one together. Vayam sitad vyakaranam vichitram. Vayam sitad vyakaranam vichitram. Mano manisa manuja nivasa. Mano manisa manujo nivasa. Gandharva vidyadhara charana prasada. Gandharva vidyadhara charana apsada. Sarva smritir asura anika virya. Svara smriti asura anika vira. Vayam sita vyakaram vit. Vayam sita vyakaranam vichitram. Mano manisa manuja nivasa. Gandharva vidyadhara charana apsara. Swara smritir asura anika vira. Others? Vaishnavis. Vayamsi, varieties of birds. Tat vyakaranam, vocables. Vichitram, artistic. Manu, the father of mankind. Manisa, thoughts. Manuja, mankind, the sons of Manu. Nivasa, residence. Gandharva, the human beings named Gandharvas. Vijithara, the Vijitharas. Charana, the Charanas. Apsara, the angels. Swara, musical rhythm. Smriti, remembrance. Asura Anika, the demoniac soldiers. Virya, prowess. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Varieties of birds are indications of His masterful artistic sense. Manu, the father of mankind, is the emblem of His standard intelligence, and humanity is His residence. The celestial species of human beings like Gandharvas, Vijitharas, Charanas, and angels all represent His musical rhythm, and the demoniac soldiers are representations of His wonderful prowess. Purport. The aesthetic sense of the Lord is manifested in the artistic, colorful creation of varieties of birds like peacocks, parrot, like the peacock, parrot, and cuckoo. The celestial species of human beings, like the Gandharvas and Vijitharas, can sing wonderfully and can entice even the minds of the heavenly demigods. Their musical rhythm represents the musical sense of the Lord. How then can He be impersonal? His musical taste, artistic sense, and standard intelligence, which is never fallible, are different signs of His supreme personality. The Manu Samhita is the standard law book for humanity, and every human being is advised to follow this great book of social knowledge. Human society is the residential quarters for the Lord. This means that the human being is meant for God realization and association with God. This life is a chance for the conditioned soul to regain his eternal God consciousness and thus fulfill the mission of life. Maharaj Prahlad is the right type of representative of the Lord in the family of Asuras. None of the living beings is away from the Lord's gigantic body. Each and every one has a particular duty in relation to the supreme body. Disruption in the matter of discharging the specific duty assigned to each and every living being is the cause of disharmony between one living being and another. But when the relation is reestablished in relation with the Supreme Lord, there is complete unity between all living beings, even up to the limit of the wild animals and human society. Lord Chaitanya displayed this living unity in the jungle of Madhya Pradesh, where even the tigers, elephants, and many other ferocious animals perfectly cooperated in glorifying the Supreme Lord. That is the way to peace and amity all over the world. Om Ginatamarandasha Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshuna Militamina Tasmai Shri Gudavena Maha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitame Navutale Swayamupakadamayam Dirati Swaparantikam. So when I moved into the temple in 1973, middle of April 1973 in Brooklyn, the press, the ISKCON press, was there. Tiffany Place, I can't remember the numbers, but we used to produce, not entirely, but to a certain degree, we would produce Prabhupada's books from that press there. Some of the small books, the layout work was done there, and then it was sent off to the printers, and some small books were actually produced right there. I can't remember which ones, but in addition to those small books that were produced there, there was these, I don't know how you refer to it, it was like a, it was a paperback, but it was like a bit larger than the small books we distribute now. It was about the size of a regular hardcover book, but it was a chapter. And as we used to produce chapters, early chapters of the second canto of the Bhagavatam, there was one, Purusha Shukta confirmed, the cause of all causes, and this chapter too, the first steps in God realization. So I remember having that, and we were distributing them, just chapters of the Bhagavatam. I was excited about this one because devotees had told me that it had an attraction for nature, the outdoors and nature. And devotees had told me that this chapter is, it shows how you can see Krishna in nature, something like that. At least I had that impression that that's what I was going to be getting. And I liked that. I thought, well, I like this, and the Bhagavad Gita talks about how Krishna, I am the light of the sun and the moon. And then I was always attracted to the sun, so I could always, it was an easy way to think of Krishna. So I was very excited, upon this coming out and reading it, because I thought, okay, this is a way I'm going to be able to further develop my Krishna consciousness, by appreciating Krishna in nature. Well, it didn't work out like that. it's quite a bit more technical than just appreciating, Krishna's the light of the sun, the light of the moon. And as we all are experiencing, as we're reading through these verses one by one, there's a lot of concepts and ideas that are brought in that somebody, especially a new devotee, would be totally unfamiliar with. And, some of the points are kind of esoteric. It's hard to visualize what's being described sometimes, and it's hard to make the connection between what the characteristic that's being referred to and the quality of Krishna that it's supporting. Anyway, it's completely perfect. It's presented by Sukadev Goswami, but anyway, I don't know if I'm the right person to be giving this class, because I have to admit, I was a Virat Rup dropout. I dropped out from seriously studying the Virat Rupa, which is, what this first this chapter is discussing about. It wasn't what I was looking for. But, as is, once again, to say, it's presented by Sukadeva Goswami. It's absolutely perfect. And I felt, maybe, I don't know if I felt guilty about it or not, but I certainly don't now, because especially since we've been studying it, I paid close attention to the purports, particularly 20, 21, 22 in this chapter, where Srila Prabhupada clearly explains that, this is a totally bona fide method of God realization, but it's a chance for the impersonalists, right? And he out and out says that in about three different purports. This is a chance for the impersonalists to connect with the personality of Godhead, because they don't, it's hard for them to have this appreciation of a personal form of God. So this is an opportunity for them to come in an impersonal way. But of course, the conclusion would be that they become personless. It's indirect, but it's meant to bring them to that same point of appreciating Krishna, the Supreme Person. So, and it's good. So, and it has, it's in that sense, it's has validity. It's not a trick. It's a strategy. It's part of a strategy. That strategy is nicely enunciated by Srila Rupa Goswami, There's a verse where he says, Yena tena prakarena manak krishna nevesayat sarve vidi nisedasur etayo evakinkara, that somehow or another, in the beginning, somehow or another, the spiritual master should devise a ways and a means to help or enable the disciple to fix their mind upon Krishna, and then the rules and regulations they can will automatically follow, yena tena, somehow or another. Right? So that's the strategy here, that, you know, once again, Bhagavatam is trying to help us. You know, Srila Sukadeva Goswami, Krishna is not different from the Bhagavatam, trying to help, trying to get everybody in. You know, the gyanis, the yogis, the karmis, let's get everybody into Krishna consciousness. But, you know, the goal is, of course, just that. Like there's those verses in the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, out of many thousands among men, one may endeavor for perfection. And of those who have achieved perfection, hardly one knows me in truth. So that's referring to, out of many thousands among men, one may be a gyani. You know, and then among the gyanis, one will know Krishna. And then further on in that chapter, Krishna says, after many births, and it might not take the gyani just one lifetime. It might take that gyani many lifetimes. That's the other verse, Bahunam Janma Namante. After many, many births, one who is actually in knowledge, who is a true gyani, he will know that he'll know me as the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very, very rare. So this is an attempt to help those gyanis. You know, to help those people who are not prepared to directly embrace the personal form of Krishna, to help them in their progressive march towards personalism, you know, towards becoming devotees of Krishna. And it might take them many, many births. See? So as devotees, as bhaktas, we can also take advantage of this, but I won't say with a grain of salt, but we should bear in mind that it's not our primary method for advancing in Krishna consciousness. It's presented by Sukadeva Goswami. It's, you know, as I said, it's perfect. It's in the Bhagavatam, which is non-different from Krishna. It's being presented by the Supreme Speaker, Sukadeva Goswami. So it's totally a bona fide process. But at the same time, it's not something that's emphasized. It's not emphasized really by Sukadeva Goswami beyond this point in the Bhagavatam. He goes on and other things. And Srila Prabhupada, for instance, in his lectures and his teachings to us, you know, Prabhupada didn't go, well, you know, this material world is hard. We have birth, death, old age, and disease, and there's so many material desires and blah, 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 and you should meditate on the Virat Rup. No. You know, his lectures would always be those things I mentioned, that we should take shelter of what? Devotional service and the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. That's what's emphasized. See, this is bona fide, but it's not what's emphasized. What is emphasized is bhakti yoga, devotional service, as given to us by Prabhupada. And what's emphasized, even within that emphasis, is the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. So that's what we should be, you know, focusing on and appreciating this, but, you know, focusing on bhakti yoga as it's been given to us by Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada did not give us bhakti yoga in any haphazard way. He gave it to us. He had a plan. There's a system behind, a method to his, well, I won't say madness, but you know, that's an expression, but a method to his genius. And in that, well, everything Prabhupada gave us is based upon principles that are presented in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, translated as the Nectar Devotion by Srila Rupa Goswami. There's one place in the Nectar Devotion, I'm not remembering exactly where it talks about how of all the different activities, 64 activities of devotional service, there are five which are considered like super important, super important. And they stand out even among all the other ones. And I hope I can get them correct. I know one is chanting Hare Krishna. Another is hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam. I think another is worshipping the deities. What? Association with devotees and worshipping the deities and living in a holy place. Those five. Okay? So those five are, there's a name for them. Something Anga. It's Panchanga. You know, the most important. Okay? Now, if you think about it, the program Prabhupada gives us incorporates all of those. You see? We're worshiping the deity, right? We're hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. And just every morning, we're executing all five of the most important limbs of devotional service. Worshipping the deity, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, chanting Hare Krishna, in kirtan, japa, associating with the devotees. If you ever noticed that, you know, the less devotees that come to the program, and the more kind of like unenthusing it is, it's, association is important. And we're encouraging each other by coming to the program and seeing each other chant and seeing each other dance and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that's important. And residing in a holy place. Well, you know, we're all here at part of the temple community. So this is a holy place, right? It's a holy place to that extent. So much devotional service is being performed here. Prabhupada visited here. See, so, so this is, you know, the point is that all somebody has to do, don't be over-intelligent. Prabhupada used to use that expression, over-intelligent. Over-intelligent means that you think you know better. Prabhupada's already kind of thought it all out. And all you have to do is, all somebody has to do if they want to become Krishna conscious is just come here and surrender and just do, when in, you know, there's that expression, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. Yeah. Well, all you got to do is, when in New Dwarka, just do as the New Dwarkans do. That's all you got to do. You just got to come here and do what everybody else is doing. You know, come to the Mangal Arati and come for the, you know, chant your japa, participate in the kirtans, come for the class, etc., etc. And that's it. You don't have to think it out. It's already been thought out. Near any time. It's already concluded. See? And it's perfect. It's taking into consideration all these most important principles of devotional service. It's being given to us in one nice, neat little package. And all we got to do is go, thank you, Srila Prabhupada, and do it, right? And among all those different things, of course, we'll talk. I'm going to zero in on one of those five most important forms of devotional service, chanting. And chanting is, you know, our primary method. I mean, I know, because I've read it. The Acharyas will say that even among those, the chanting is the essence of the essence. It's a primary means or method of advancing in Krishna consciousness. And right from day one, practically, when you become a devotee, you know, you hear, there was that address Prabhupada gave where he explains about the Hare Krishna mantra. And in that he says that the chanting should be like that of a child crying for its mother. You know, like a genuine urgency and need. That's what a child's expressing. That's the essence of that, you know, child crying, that feeling. I need you, Mom! You know, come, now! Like that. So we should be chanting in that mood. And so, you know, that's something that we're supposed to think about that. We're supposed to try to do that. A thought came to me this morning, another example of how we should be chanting is we should be chanting in the mood of Draupadi when she was in the that assembly and they were trying to insult her. See, so we should be chanting in the mood that she concluded with, which I hope I get all the details accurate. It started off, you know, everybody was familiar with that story. They, the Pandavas lost her somehow, supposedly, in a gambling match, dice, like that. So then Karna, who was an enemy, he had a what's it called? He had a gripe. You know, he wanted to marry her, and she didn't want to marry him. She wanted to marry Arjuna. So when they had a Swayamvar, where all these princes came, and they were going to compete, and whoever won would get her. She was the prize, so to speak. But so Karna came forward to compete, and she said, no. He can't compete. He's not a Kshatriya. He's a Sudra, so he can't compete. And Karna was really insulted by that. Sutta, okay, which is maybe even lower than a Sudra, I don't know. But he wasn't qualified, as far as she was concerned, and he felt insulted by that. And he wanted to get revenge. And this was his opportunity. You know, she was lost now. She was the property of the Kauravas. So he suggested to Duryodhana, you know, after she was lost, she said, okay, so she's our property now. Let's see her beauty, you know, let's see her naked beauty. And, okay, you know, Duryodhana was evil. He went along with it. And then Dusasana started to try to disrobe her. So at first, now Draupadi is, she's certainly an advanced devotee. And I don't know if I'm 100% correct. I think she's like a certified pure devotee. But maybe that's not completely accurate. But she's certainly an advanced devotee. So at least initially, they were trying to take off her sari, Dusasana. And she was struggling with all her might to keep her sari on. And I have to be honest, I don't remember reading this, or even hearing Prabhupada say it, but I could imagine she was also, even at that time, thinking of Krishna, you know, to a certain extent. She was a Krishna conscious person. But in any event, okay, so that was the first stage. And she realized, no, this isn't working. So then there's a picture of her where she's trying to keep her sari on with one hand, and she's kind of holding one hand up in the air. You know, she's like simultaneously struggling to keep the sari, and she's praying to Krishna. And that didn't work. So then at one point, shortly, not too long after that, she realized, hey, Govinda. She just threw her hands up in the air, and she realized, it's pointless, it's futile for me to try to struggle to keep my sari on. I just can't. It's not going to work. It's a mismatch here. I'm just a little woman. This is like a super kshatriya, and forget it. So she just decided to completely depend upon Krishna. So she just threw her hand. She let go of the sari completely with both hands, and she put her hands up. Hey, Govinda, you know. And Prabhupada said she was saying, by saying that, she was saying, Krishna, you could now protect me or whatever as you like. I'm totally surrendered unto you. So. We should chant like that. You see, in other words, sometimes we're chanting and we're making plans. That's like the first stage. You know, you're chanting. So, you know, you've made a decision to be Krishna conscious, otherwise you wouldn't be chanting. But you're chanting and you're making plans about, I'm going to do this service, and as a result of doing that, that'll happen, and as a result of doing that, that'll happen, and I'll go here and I'll move there and I'll get, whatever. You're making plans. That's like when Draupadi was wanting help from Krishna, but struggling to keep it together herself on her own strength. The next stage is you might be chanting and you're praying. You know, you're praying to Krishna. That's like Draupadi when she was, you know, struggling, but she was also praying. That's also not bad, but it's not the perfectional stage. What we're recommended to do is just be like Draupadi in that third stage Draupadi. Whereas when she just was let go, and she's just going to depend on Krishna. You see? So the analogy of that would be the equivalent of that would be that you're chanting and you're just taking shelter of the chanting. No, you're not chanting and planning. You're not chanting and praying. You're chanting and chanting. You're really just trying to chant and hear. Once Prabhupada was asked by a devotee, back late 60s, he says, Prabhupada, what should we think about when we're chanting? And Prabhupada said, this is the exact answer. Think about? He said, when you're chanting, just try to hear the chanting. So just try to get into the chanting. When we're chanting, we shouldn't be trying to plan, you know, our lives or our service like that, or praying even, but just try to chant and be into the chanting. Something that's helpful along those lines, it's an instruction of Prabhupada, is in the, I've mentioned this, you know, several times in previous classes in the Anchalila Volume 1. There's that famous pastime with Haridas Thakur, you know, when he was in Benapole, and Papa talks about how he put a cottage. He had a cottage on the banks of the Ganges River, and he used to day and night chant the Hare Krishna mantra, and he chanted 300,000 names a day, which is like a, I think 192 or 176 rounds or something like that. Anyway, he's chanting day and night. But Prabhupada in the purport says that we can't imitate Haridas Thakur. He says that kind of chanting is for a mukta purush, an eternally liberated soul. He said, but we can follow in his footsteps. And then Prabhupada went on to explain what that meant. Specifically, how do you follow in his footsteps? He said, by we could chant 16 rounds with a vow, in front of the Tulsi plant. And he said that this, by doing that, simply by doing that, one can become spiritually strong. And then the same, just a couple sentences down, he says, so therefore we request the members of the Krishna consciousness movement to follow Haridas Thakur's example very rigidly. Chanting 16 rounds does not take much time, nor is worshipping the Tulsi plant difficult. And then he goes, he concludes the purport by saying, but the process has immense spiritual potency. One should not miss this opportunity. So there's a good, very practical, concrete, doable suggestion or instruction, suggestion from Prabhupada or instruction of how we can, kind of really improve our chanting by doing it in the temple, in this, if possible, or in the presence of a Tulsi plant. And anyway, that instruction's there. So, and then concluding point is if we try to follow in the footsteps of Draupadi, what happened when Draupadi did that? She just, she just decided to totally surrender to Krishna, hey Govinda. And then Krishna supplied unlimited sari. You see? She wasn't doing that. She wasn't holding on to the sari. And Dusasan, he didn't stop. He didn't go. He didn't get scared or something like that and go, uh-oh, I better stop now. He just kept, he was pulling sari more and more and more and more, right? And Krishna just kept supplying more and more sari. And then they realized, I think he just kind of got pooped out. And he just, okay, forget it. Can't disrobe her. So in the same way, when we, follow in Draupadi's footsteps and try to chant like that, and that, and that with that mood, that intensity, and that, it's more than just like a, it's not a theatrical performance. It's like a whole life way of living. We try to mold our life in such a way that we're coming into that Draupadi consciousness of trying to depend on Krishna fully, then Krishna will supply unlimited sari in our life. See? In other words, Krishna will be there. Krishna, just like Krishna, he was there. But when Draupadi took full shelter of Krishna, then there was the full reciprocation. So in the same way, when Krishna sees that we're trying to fully depend on him, then he becomes more interested. He's always interested, but he becomes even more attentive, and to try to, and that attention will takes the form of him doing things to try to help us progress to the point of pure devotional service as quickly and as easily as he possibly can. That's what Krishna's reciprocation will be in our case. See, he can see that this person really wants pure devotional service. Okay, I'm going to really try to help him come to that point. And then, like that. So I'll stop there. Does anybody have anything they'd like to say? First thing that I saw up was such a... No. Can anybody see the time that I... How did I do? Okay, good.
Thank you, Prabhu. Actually, it's a comment. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
So, yeah, that famous statement about that one should chant like the crying of a child for the mother. That's one. And the other one that you mentioned, that Prabhupada said that one should be able to hear the chanting. That you chant louder, you can hear your own chanting.
Yeah.
So, combining those things together, however, I was thinking that that's totally agreeable with that, 100%. But I'm just the comment is that sometimes devotees take it so literally that in the temple, in the association of many devotees, they just scream and then they disturb all the other devotees. So they have to be aware of that and being, my request, respectful to somebody else to be able to hear his chanting too. Because, I don't care. I'm very frustrated. I really want to hear my chanting. I have problems. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. But come on.
Who's the rascal who's doing that?
So, regard, I can just mention an example that Giriraj Maharaj told me.
Uh-huh.
He was sitting down there. He came and he said, because Prabhupada's tape was playing, he said, he came. He was actually sitting down and then he came. He said, actually, Prabhupada said, don't even hear that. you hear your own chanting. And then I look at Maharaj and I say, Maharaj, what about if somebody else is chanting too loud like that? He says, well, the authority should be able to talk to this person and, you know, in such a way that doesn't create disturbance. So that's my comment.
Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe some of us are chanting 16 rounds of kirtan as opposed to 16 rounds of japa.
Hare Krishna. So, Vrihupati Prabhu, I'd like to ask you your question. What you would say to someone who's been coming around the temple for some time and for someone who has been coming around the temple
only a husband can get
for
away with
some
that,
time, okay. Who, you know, has a basic grasp of the philosophy and you know, they wonder why it is that, you know, when we have a philosophy, basic philosophy, which you learn first day, first week that you come, that we're not the body, why it is that the devotees who have feminine bodies are actually excluded from the majority of the program and are just, their participation is just in the sense of almost just a backup, you could say, and they're never asked to take the front line at all. And people ask that. We may think nobody notices because we have so many words and we say so many things, but a lot of people who come to the temple, they're very curious about this, and they even wonder if we're Muslims sometimes because we also cover our heads. So I wonder what you would say to that.
Okay. That's a good question. Well, the question is, how is it that women seem to be marginalized? You know, right? Marginalized. In other words, is the women come to the program, but you don't see women leading Tulsi Kirtan. There's women aren't leading kirtans. Generally, they're a backseat as far as giving classes goes. You know, very much a backseat in the movement. And that was the gist of it, right? Okay. So my response to that would be this, that I think a person who is very concerned about that, and I think it is something that somebody could legitimately be concerned about, should research and find out what was Prabhupada's standard for that. And then if it was actually, in fact, a standard that supported a more full participation of women in the program, like specifically leading kirtan, giving class more regularly, et cetera, then that should be brought to the attention of authorities. And then that should be things should be changed in that direction. Now, to be honest with you, sometimes things go on in ISKCON that were, and they become part of the culture. They weren't actually introduced by Prabhupada. And that this could be one of them. I haven't personally researched it myself because I'm in a man's body and just... I don't think it's important. I think it's extremely important, but I'm just, because it's not my problem, so to speak, I'm kind of keeping my, you know, focusing on other things. But I really think it's something that you should be researched. And if you could find evidence that, as far as Prabhupada was concerned, women should do this, should do that, should do this, should do that, then nobody's got a leg to stand on. No authority has a leg to stand on. It should be introduced, and that's what should be happening. What Prabhupada gave us. Not what somebody, I don't want to blaspheme or criticize anybody, not what some devotee, not so-called, but follower of Prabhupada misunderstood that should be the standard. That, okay? Yeah, Maharaj wanted to say something. Maharaj wanted to speak, and then we'll take a, whatever.
Thank you for a nice class. You made a lot of wonderful points. There was just one I wanted to clarify just a little bit, and that is, by the way, the point that was just made, it's just too big a subject right now for me to tackle. It goes back to Vedic culture, the education of women during Vedic culture, and the education of women today, which is completely different, and I don't mean the facts or the ideas, but I'm just saying the amount of women who are educated today compared to, in general, Vedic culture is far, far, far. It's mandatory today for women, men, to both be educated equally, where that was not the case. The only persons who would get higher the higher philosophical cultural education were those in the royal families, like not just Draupadi, but also Kunti Devi, she would get it, and also the mother of Duryodhana. These were all royal women, and they could sit in the balcony, so to speak, and listen to all the philosophical discussions. This was not the case for the ordinary women. They were generally dealing with aspects of their particular caste, whether it might have been farm caste or Kshatriya caste or whatever it might be. But that was, I'm simply mentioning that's just a basic idea of why there was a difference in that, why certain women were allowed and certain women were not allowed due to the fact that they were very busy. But what I wanted to mention was not that. What I simply wish to say is that what you had said is that Draupadi, in that third stage that you mentioned, that was like her state of surrender. Okay, first of all, Draupadi was already surrendered. That was not her chance to surrender. She was already surrendered long, long ago.
Yeah.
That's first thing. Second of all, some devotees don't know that Draupadi, she was not a normal human being. She was a demigoddess. She was born from a fire sacrifice. And she had a lot of knowledge just from being amongst the demigods. Okay, that's one thing. But the main point I wanted to make is that Draupadi, when she put up her arms, she was calling for help. It was a desperate cry. Krishna, help me. Protect my honor. Honor was a very big thing with Draupadi and any woman. They didn't want to be in any way disparaged or, you know, looked down upon. So basically that's what she was crying out for. I can't defend myself. My husbands are not defending me. I need a protector. And I know you are all powerful. So she throws up her arms and says, please, basically, protect me from this brute. That's what he was.
Uh-huh.
Any man who does that is a brute. It's an animal, worse than an animal. Animals, you know, they just do for food. But anyway, that was the main point. Please save me, protect me, help me. Not I surrender unto you, now please take care of me.
Right.
The surrender was long ago, and we see that in other aspects, other pastimes.
Yeah,
and
you.
And she has husbands who are completely surrendered also.
Yeah.
So just being with them would automatically create a
that's assimilation. Good. Thank you for that clarification. And in the same way, Maya is just like that brute, Dushasan, was trying to strip her of her sari. Maya, her job, she's trying to strip us of our devotional service. You know, we're, she's, that's what she's trying to do that. So in the same way, we should cry to Krishna, Krishna, help me, save me, protect me. Don't let Maya pull me back out there again.
Yeah.
I want to, please give me shelter at your lotus feet. That's the, that would be the analogy part of it.
Yeah, there's another point. There was something else, but it's not so important. The point you've just
if
made
it comes back
fine.
To you, we'll
there was a mood of desperation in her. You had mentioned in the talk is that they wanted to see her nudity. That was not the main point. They wanted to take vengeance upon her.
Humiliate her, yeah.
And the vengeance was, you insulted us in front of a big assembly. You rejected Karna just because he was a Suta. He came from a family in which he had so-called mother who is a Brahmin and a father who was a Kshatriya. That's a Suta, and they lived in a certain community. The name of that community, I can't remember, but it was awarded to by Duryodhana. It was awarded to Karna. He received that. He became a king of that. If you remember,
Anga.
There was a big big tournament of all the Kshatriyas, and Arjuna did not want to, he didn't want to fight with Karna because he wasn't a Kshatriya. He was a Suta, and he had every right to reject that kind. So what happened is Duryodhana decided, since they had a certain amount of power with his father, is that they would make Karna a king, which would give him the right to fight with Arjuna, because Arjuna was of the royal, he was of the royal family. He was a son of Pandu, so to speak. He's called a son because he was raised by Indra, but he's not a biological son. But that's not counting. Vedic culture, it's who raises you is the father. Mm-hmm. That's the way it's always thought of. So, but anyway, main point is Karna was, he was raised by a Suta. Okay, so therefore he was considered a Suta, which I just described. And as a result of being raised as a Suta, he was not qualified to fight with Arjuna. That came out by the sages. Kripacharya brought that out. He says, no, if Arjuna doesn't want to fight him, it's perfectly okay because after all, he's on a lower level. So that's when Duryodhana came in and he said to his father, why don't we make this Karna, make him a king. We'll give him Anga, where he was born and where all the suttas live. So Dhritarashtra, of course, he wanted to cohere with his son because his son wanted to become king, and that's what Dhritarashtra wanted. So what they did is they made him right on the assembly ground. Right there, they made Karna a king. He was the king of Anga. So then he had the right to challenge Arjuna. And he did whatever Arjuna did, he did do. He was equally qualified. And of course, that was a disturbance to the Pandavas. And nobody knew who he was. They knew who he was from the past. And they knew that he was just another warrior. But he had already had taken training from Parashuram. And Parashuram was considered among the greatest of warriors. And so he got the same training that Arjuna got the training, of course, from Dronacharya, who got it from Parashuram. So it was a big insult because everybody was thinking Arjuna is the best, whereas Karna equaled him in that tournament.
Don't get Amala Bakhmaraj started on the Mahabharata. That's what you got now.
Sorry about that. My apologies many, many times. Big talker. Little doer.
Nam Kirtan, our old friend Nam Kirtan.
Thank you, Brigapati, for the very... Thank you, Brigapati, for the wonderful class. I have a comment and a question. Comment to what Shyamapriya was saying is that it's a very relevant question because particularly nowadays the social norms are changing, you know, from your time and when you were growing up in the 60s and 70s to particularly my time and even now, things are changing very dramatically. Where the challenge is for ISKCON is how do we keep the philosophy as it is, at the same time be relevant to the time that we're at. Because the whole
socially
point,
correct.
Yeah, so well, not necessarily socially correct, but to be relevant to mm-hmm. the times and the people that we're preaching to. Because what makes ISKCON and what Prabhupada gave us so distinct from so much of Indian culture or Indian philosophy is that is very much a proselytizing movement, very much preaching movement. It's very based on that, what Prabhupada gave us. And this particular issue is very sensitive amongst men and women.
So what's the solution?
So it's a challenge that we have to really kind of meditate on. I was just noticing that was a good question. That's something we have to really consider because, you know, even during the 70s and 80s or what have you, that was a different time than it is now. And we have to kind of consider the time now and how do we, you know, keep it at the philosophy as it is, but still attract people so they don't become offended.
I'd like to make one comment.
Sure.
It's your comment. Yesterday I was down at Laguna Beach visiting my daughter and grandson. So I heard Tukaram has been, 3 years ago, this program started in Long Beach. You know, he has that restaurant down there, Himsa Cafe. It's a vegan restaurant. And the people who were working there, they wanted to live close because, you know, it's convenient for their work. So the landlord caught wind of that, and he offered them a place about 8 blocks away. So they took in. There's only 4 or 5 of them. Krishna Shakti, Krishna Garanga's son, was one of them. And they thought, well, we're living here, we're devotees, we should do something Krishna conscious. So they decided to have a program on Saturday nights. And they invited Tukaram. Mm. And the program was to start off with was just those 4 or 5 people and Tukaram coming. Mm. Anyway, it grew. About a year and a half ago, they were getting like 30 people. Anyway, now he gets 60 to 80 people every Saturday. They're all Westerners, young people between the age of 20 and 35. 60 to 80. So the point is, you gotta change with the times, but at the same time keep the essence. Mm. I mean, that's what we want. We want to get 60 to 80 young Westerners coming to a program. Mm. Like here at our Sunday feast, we're getting, you know, the same old Indian people and one or two kind of maybe new people like that. So you gotta, that's part of what
challenge.
Being a preacher means. You gotta rack your brains to figure out how to preserve the sanctity of the thing, but at the same time attract people. That's the big challenge.
Thank you. And then my question was, due to your great success over the many years of distributing so many books and doing book distribution for such a long time, and then you're in the relevance of what you're saying about chanting, how did you yourself become so successful over the years and continue to distribute so many books in regards to your chanting, in the sense that what is your technique in, as far as your sadhana and your actual chanting in reference to your preaching and distributing so many books?
Sacha Denoise Association. Now, it's too long a question to answer because we're already kind of over time.
Sure.
But does anybody have anything they're really burning to say? I don't want to frustrate anybody, but at the same time, we've got to be... Okay, so we'll have to end there. Sorry. Thank you. Thank you very much. Kantor Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.